The governor of Puerto Rico said today it was a tough decision to miss a multi-million dollar debt payment. In South Jersey this morning, Atlantic City Mayor Don Guardian used the same language to describe his decision to pay the city's bondholders. I'm Brad Linder, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller's off this evening. As WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, it was another close call for the former gambling mecca that's now living paycheck to paycheck.
Because quarterly tax receipts are rolling in this week, Mayor Don Guardian says the city was able to pull together enough for $1.8 million in bond payments. But that doesn't mean Atlantic City's finances are on the upswing.
We're on the brink. I mean, we're trying to get through day to day. We've stopped making purchases weeks ago. We certainly haven't replaced any staff.
Guardian has to pay city workers on Friday and send a payment to the public schools next week. He expects to meet both obligations. But not everybody thought the mayor's announcement was newsworthy. Governor Chris Christie, who supports a state takeover of the financially failing resort town, says making a bond payment is no cause for celebration.
It tells you how bad off Atlantic City is. That's something that 565 municipalities do on a regular basis, which is make their debt payments, is worthy of a press release and a press conference by the people in Atlantic City that you made your debt payment. You know, what's next? Does he want a gold medal for that?
A bill moving toward a vote in the state assembly this week falls short of a complete state takeover. It gives the city budgetary benchmarks to meet and more closely involves local officials. City Council President Marty Small urged state leaders to approve it by invoking a quote from Martin Luther King Jr.
It says, "The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands at moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands in times of challenge and controversy. This is both challenging and controversial times. Do the right thing."
The next bond payment is due in early June. Mayor Guardian says he hopes to have the money for it, but it'd be foolish to make that promise. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Therapy and not pills should be the first approach for people suffering with insomnia. That's according to new guidelines from the American College of Physicians, an influential national internal medicine organization. Mike and Scott reports from WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk.
Insomnia affects about 10% of American adults. It results in fatigue, of course, but also diminishes cognition, alertness, and general health. Sleeping pills do the trick for many people, but they are not meant to be taken for more than 4 or 5 weeks, cautions Wayne Riley. He heads the American College of Physicians.
The first-line treatment for chronic insomnia should be cognitive behavioral therapy.
When CBT, as it's called for short, is used to address sleep, patients first have to learn a counterintuitive lesson.
Less is more. Less time in bed is better.
That's Michael Perlis. He's director of the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Program at the University of Pennsylvania.
If you're awake, spend that time somewhere else. Now, executing that as part of a general therapy is more complicated, but that is the rule of thumb.
Perlis says CBT works for 50 to 70% of people with insomnia, and while it may take several weeks of therapy, the effects last.
And that's where it really distinguishes itself from medical therapy, is that there's no pill on this planet that will give you sustainability of treatment gains after treatment is discontinued.
CBT for insomnia starts with a careful assessment of sleep routines and teaches people ways to change their sleep behaviors. I'm Mike and Scott, WHYY News.
Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia had been the longest-serving member of the country's highest court when he died earlier this year. For the past 3 decades, he was also a reliably conservative voice on the court. Kevin Walsh is a professor of law at the University of Richmond School of Law and served as one of Justice Scalia's law clerks. He'll be at the National Constitution Center this evening, where he and two other former clerks will be discussing Antonin Scalia's legacy. Professor Walsh, thanks for joining us.
Very happy to be here.
So what was it like working with Justice Scalia?
It was a supremely intellectually challenging experience. Being able to observe a mind like that at work is really an amazing thing. And he kept us on our toes.
What was he like as a person in the time that you got to know him?
He's fairly gregarious, great sense of humor. As a boss, had very high expectations of us, and he formed friendships really across ideological divides.
He was known as a conservative in a couple of ways. One was that he was a devout Catholic. What role did his faith play in his position?
I think that's hard to say. I saw a speech that he gave actually here in Philadelphia out at Villanova where he said, just like there's no Catholic way to make a hamburger, there's no Catholic way to judge a case. He said that his faith told him not to lie, so don't lie about the law, and to get it right. If there was a conflict between the requirements of his faith and the requirements of his job, he said that he would resign.
He was also known as an originalist. What does that mean?
An originalist looks to apply the original law of the Constitution. An originalist will look to the original meaning, not try to be swayed by what's happened over time.
Now, some of the other justices have slightly differing views and view the Constitution as a little bit more malleable or something that evolves over time or the interpretation of it evolves over time. What were his relationships with his peers like?
In a small institution like the Supreme Court, where you have nine justices, the personal relationships turn out to be important. These are not the acrimonious relationships that you might expect, given some of the back and forth that you see in the opinions. He certainly was a pull-no-punches kind of writer, but that didn't stop him from forming very close personal friendships with the other justices. There is a lot that gets done at the court that you don't read about in the newspapers, right? That doesn't make these controversial 5-4 decisions. They are a set of lawyers working through legal problems, and they do it in a conference where they sit around a table and they go in a certain order. And it's very important that the relationships be maintained.
When you think of him, is there a story that comes to mind, something that sort of embodies what it was like?
Well, I'll give you two. Yeah. One's in the workplace, and that was our very first meeting with when all four law clerks are there, and we're meeting with him to go over kind of expectations about the job. I remember he impressed on us the importance of confidentiality and how we would never have a job if he had anything to do with it, if we ever leaked anything. And, you know, that brought whenever there's a leak or something like that, I always think, well, they didn't get the talk that we got. On the personal side, we had my wife and I had a baby that was born the year I was clerking for him, and we weren't comfortable leaving her with a babysitter. So we went over to dinner at his house, and we thought, well, he's got nine kids. Maybe we can bring one. And sure enough, I always tell my daughter, there you were, passed out in a onesie on Justice Scalia's living room, and the conversation just went on as if it's totally normal. He was a family man. He was very interested in his clerks' families, and you know, that's something that stands out to me now.
Kevin, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
Kevin Walsh is professor of law at the University of Richmond and former clerk to Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. He's one of three of the late justice's former law clerks who will be speaking at the National Constitution Center this evening at 6:30. Can you be in legal trouble for sending a text message that distracts a driver right before an accident? A judge in western Pennsylvania says the answer is yes. WHYY's Bobby Allen tells us what this means.
The issue centers on a wrongful death civil lawsuit out of Lawrence County, where a judge allowed two men to be listed as defendants because they were texting with a woman right before she struck and killed a man on a motorcycle.
If you are sending texts to a person, which in turn is contributing to them being distracted, why shouldn't you be held liable?
That's attorney Doug Alcott. He's also suing the driver, who served time after pleading guilty to involuntary manslaughter. In 2013, a New Jersey appeals court found that if a person knows someone is driving and sends a text to that person, the texter could be held partially responsible if the driver crashes. The Pennsylvania judge cited that Jersey case.
We don't want people running around thinking, oh my gosh, I sent a text and now, you know, somebody's going to sue me for it. You know, the standard is we have to be able to show that he knew or should have known that she was driving and that she would have responded while driving.
Alcott says his case and the Jersey one are the only two instances that courts have addressed the issue of texter liability. Philadelphia personal injury attorney Heidi Villari says it'll be treated on a case-by-case basis until a state appeals court weighs in or until state legislatures pass a new law. But she says the judge's decision to let a texter be sued is important.
The courts are pushing back on the strong-willed texters out there that are refusing to actually follow the law.
Under Pennsylvania law, texting while driving is illegal, but only punishable with a summary offense of $50. State figures show that nearly 15,000 crashes across Pennsylvania involved a distracted driver last year. Those crashes claimed 61 lives. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Still ahead, if you could offer some advice to your younger self, what would it be?
Hi there, little one. Welcome, welcome. You are about to embark on one of the most challenging, confusing, erratic, yet somehow meaningful and joyful adventures of your short life. Do not let the weight of that wash over you lightly.
That's coming up as NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. College is often heralded as the best 4 years of your life, but it can be a challenging time. Dear Penn Freshman is a new project where University of Pennsylvania students write letters to the former selves. In the process, the project's creators hope to foster a more supportive culture. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Anne Hoffman reports.
In her hip University City apartment, Lauren McCann, a senior at Penn, reads me her letter over a cup of tea.
Hi there, little one. Welcome, welcome. You are about to embark on one of the most challenging, confusing, erratic, yet somehow meaningful and joyful adventures of your short life. Do not let the weight of that wash over you lightly.
McCann and some other students got the idea to start Dear Penn Freshman at a class on organizational behavior. The goal? To change the culture at Penn, which McCann says has some great aspects and some not-so-great aspects.
They have like this phenomenon at Penn they call like Penn Face, which is like this idea that people sort of just put on this mask, that they have everything is like super breezy, easy for them. They know exactly what they're going to do for the next 4 years and the next 50 years once we graduate.
But the letters show the cracks in that Penn Face facade. McCann started to ask for submissions, and she gradually got a few that spoke about hard topics, like getting rejected from every club or getting cheated on by a first love.
We are hoping that people, you know, everyone wants to make their own mistakes, but hopefully by reading our advice, they'd be able to have a better, happier time here at Penn.
Those acts of self-disclosure can go a long way toward changing an environment, says John Domino, the director of counseling services at Temple University.
People feel less alone when they hear the stories because they can see themselves in other stories and experiences.
And one novel aspect is that the advice isn't coming from professors or mentors, but students themselves.
I think young people, college students, definitely tend to look to peers for information and advice.
Penn senior Bobby Lindquist submitted a letter for the project because during his early college years, he was fixated on becoming a better person. He even earned the tongue-in-cheek nickname Bodhisattva Bobby from a professor. He tried to give as much as he could to others, but he judged himself when he thought he came up short.
Over the time I've had at Penn, I've definitely found that it's been difficult to practice self-compassion.
His letter has a whole section called Commit to What You Care About, but he warns his younger self not to take on too much. He writes, "Do more by doing less." And now, instead of trying to be perfect, he sees the limitations of his old mindset.
The way I like to think about it is like a bathtub with like the water is running like full speed, but the drain is also open. So you never are really filling up.
Lindquist says he found fellowship in other people's letters, and now the project is getting attention beyond Penn. Lauren McCann says she's been contacted by other Ivy League schools about starting their own versions of the letters, and she's working with fine arts students to take the concept off the internet and organize a show. For now, she reads me the end of her letter.
Number 9. Let go of any preconceived notions of just how your life will pan out, job-wise, relationship-wise, and anything otherwise. Being able to be confident in your uncertainty is the bravest thing you could possibly do. Number 10.
Anne Hoffman, WHYY News.
This weekend's rain and chill notwithstanding, the days are getting warmer as we approach the summer. In their weekly conversation, NewsWorks Tonight host Dave Heller and Franklin Institute chief astronomer Derek Pitts mark a mini-seasonal milestone.
Derek, we are now just on the other side of a notable day.
We've made a major change. We've gone from the front side of spring to the back side of spring, I guess you might be able to call it, as in yesterday or these few days right around the beginning of May mark this point of a cross-quarter day. A point when we are halfway between the first day of spring and the first day of summer.
These days tend to have names.
They do tend to have names. The most common name for this particular time of year is May Day. Everybody knows May Day. However, there's a much more arcane name for this, which is Beltane or Beltane, and it might sound familiar if you are an aficionado of the Celtic civilization, because there was, in fact, a large bonfire celebration held by the Celts at this time of year.
Derek, let's note, 55 years ago this Thursday, the first American got a very unique view of the revolving Earth.
Yes, indeed. This was Alan Shepard's suborbital flight that he took from Cape Canaveral, Florida, up for just about 15 minutes to prove that, indeed, America could put an American in space. This is immediately following the Russians' first launch of a human in space. Yuri Gagarin became the first person in space on April 12th, just barely a month beforehand. And America knew that we had to answer and answer quickly. Otherwise, we felt like we'd be buried under the Russian onslaught into space. So the Shepard launch was pulled together as quickly as possible. And, of course, you know, there were some problems of a delayed launch time. But as it turned out, Alan Shepard was very cool on the pad and waited as long as it took to get everything together and then spent a very, very short time in space.
But essentially an up-down rather than around and around.
Right. So this up-down experience that Alan Shepard had is going to be very much like the experience that future space tourists have when they do the similar kind of flight, but in a much more accommodating spacecraft than Alan Shepard had. Remember, he was essentially what they were calling at the time spam in a can, which you have a human squeezed into a tiny little space in the Freedom 7 Mercury spacecraft with virtually no room to move around at all, just enough room to be able to manipulate the controls. But for future space tourists, which will be coming up in the not-too-distant future, just a few years from now, people will be able to travel together as a group of maybe 12 at a time, fly up to this level of space, 62 miles and above, and have an opportunity to experience weightlessness, but to be able to free float in weightlessness, which is why those folks who have decided to make this trip have to do training. They have to do training to understand how to resist the G-forces for that very, very brief period of time to make sure that their entire trip is just as pleasant as it can be.
Now, let's note a few years back, you subjected yourself to the rigors of that kind of a simulation, indeed.
Indeed, I did. I did part of the testing for how to become a space tourist flying on the Virgin Galactic Spaceship 2. I didn't take that trip, but I went to the training location that's just outside Philadelphia in Lower Bucks County, and I did the training out there. And it really was a very interesting process. And I learned how to counteract the G-forces. Now, of course, the reason why I'm doing this is that one of the things that G-force does is if you're sitting in the proper orientation and the G-force presses on you, it prevents your heart from pumping blood all the way up to your brain. So there are exercises, there are things that you do with your body to clench your body, to force blood to your brain under the G-force stress. This is the kind of training that fighter pilots go through all of the time so that they can stand very, very high levels of G-force without blacking out.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
That's Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute, speaking with Newsworks Tonight host Dave Heller. Finally, Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney was in Washington over the weekend for the White House Correspondents' Dinner. He had some laughs, and he made some contacts, says WHYY's Tom McDonald.
If this material works well, I'm going to use it at Goldman Sachs next year. Earn me some serious Tubmans.
Mayor Jim Kenney went as a guest of Comcast David Cohen to hear the jokes, jests, and barbs. Kenney says he was impressed with President Obama's speech.
He just is a smooth operator, man. He can deliver it. And it was a nice time. I was glad I went.
The mayor says he was a little starstruck by all the Hollywood actors, sports celebrities, and of course political figures, including the president, vice president, and Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders.
I met people that I had not known before and developed hopefully a little relationship with, the news director of MSNBC. And I mean, there was a lot of nice conversations and interactions that I had with folks there, and it was well worth the trip.
I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Brad Linder for Newsworks Tonight.